Welcome to Soccer Morning on Backheel.com. Here's your host, Jason Davis.
Here we go, Friday episode of Soccer Morning, brought to you by WorldSoccerTalk.com. Welcome in to a big, big program on a Friday. Perhaps you're still hungover from watching llamas run through Arizona or determining what color that damn dress was. What color was that damn dress in the end? Was it black or black and blue, or was it gold? I saw it both ways. It was freaky. That was the internet yesterday. Was there soccer? There was soccer. We'll certainly talk about that. We've got an excellent lineup of guests today on Soccer Morning. Daryl Lovell from down in Houston, Texas, will join us to talk about the preparations for the 2015 season for the Houston Dynamo. Remember, Dom Kinnear's out, moved on to San Jose. Owen Coyle, Scottish manager, last in England, made his name in England, jumps over to the United States. This is not usually a recipe for success in MLS. The foreign manager doesn't understand the rules, needs to get up to speed very quickly, maybe needs to learn about the American player, the CONCACAF player. We'll talk to Daryl about all of that. Should be a fascinating season in Houston this time around. Thomas Floyd from Goal will join us to talk about DC United. It did not go well for DC United in Costa Rica last night. 5-2 losers to Alajuelense. Almost got it that time. 5-2 in the CONCACAF Champions League first leg of the quarterfinals. Going to be tough to turn that around at RFK. So it doesn't look good for MLS teams in this year's competition. Remember, Montreal, a surprising draw, 2-2 against Pachuca in Mexico. But I still think everybody has Pachuca as the favorites to finish out that series. And at 11 o'clock, a bonus guest for you. We're going to do some extra time here on Soccer Morning. Dave Zirin, Edge of Sports on Twitter, writer on many topics in many places, will join us. We'll talk to him about an item he has at The Nation about the MLS, the potential MLS Players Union strike. Will this be an effective strike? How does this relate to the context of American sports as we understand it? He quotes Taylor Twellman in this piece, saying that this could be MLS's Curt Flood moment. If you know your baseball history, you know Curt Flood. You know he was the man. He's the Bosman of baseball. Broke through and sued the league and successfully got his free agency back in the 70s. And we have free agency in the NFL. We have free agency in NBA basketball. We have free agency in the NHL. MLS is behind the times on this. The league is not budging. How does that impact how we think about this process? So a very good discussion coming up with Dave Zirin today. Let's do the headlines. Let's talk about a little bit about what happened yesterday that wasn't llamas and dresses. You have the, and I meant to mention this yesterday, getting around to it now. The Greek League has been suspended. The Greek top division in Greece has been suspended for a third time because of violence at matches. Not only is Greece going through all of those austerity measures they've been dealing with, and now talking to the European Union about getting an extension on their repayment of loans. Economic strife in Greece, and we've seen over the last couple of years how this has impacted football and soccer. Now you have violence at matches between rivals Olympiakos and Panathinaikos, and a brawl between club officials Tuesday at a board meeting of league organizers. When it gets to that level, when it gets to the management level, when guys in suits are brawling, that's not good. That's bad. That's a reason to maybe suspend the league. Trouble in Greece. Europa League yesterday, you had a couple of things happen that were of interest. Number one, probably most important to point out, Feyenoord and Roma there in Rotterdam. Feyenoord fans throwing an inflatable banana on the field. After a referee decision that went against the home team, there was other items thrown on the field and the game was suspended. Those two things are unconnected as far as I'm aware. Or the referee may have taken into account the banana incident as he decided to take the players off the field for a while. But the incident with the banana is the troubling thing. Now, there is some question as to whether or not this was racially motivated. But it's not as though the Netherlands is without these issues. We saw when Josie Altidore was playing in the country that he was racially abused. Feyenoord fans themselves, some Feyenoord fans, a portion of the Feyenoord fan base, has a reputation for just being ugly mugs. for doing bad things, for chanting things that they shouldn't, for throwing things on the field that they shouldn't. If this is racially motivated, I want to say my gut instinct is to throw the ban hammer down. Do something major. Give them send a message. FIFA has been dancing around these issues for so long. Do something. And yet I know at the same time, it's treating the symptom and not the cause. Whether or not you can get to that root cause is an open question. Whether or not football and FIFA is in a position to get to that root cause, I'm not so sure. But you can't let it go, certainly. Also in the Europa League yesterday, Liverpool crashing out to Besiktas on penalties. Do you feel bad for Dejan Lovren today? Stepping up with a chance to extend penalties into sudden death, and he just... Hits it over the crossbar by a good 10 yards, it seemed like. It was nowhere close in the end. Do you feel a little bad for Dejan Lovren, or do you put some of this on Brendan Rodgers? They went into that match with every opportunity to advance. People talking about Liverpool as Europa League favorites, a chance to get in the Champions League if they won that competition, should they not finish in the top four in England. And they just... I give Besiktas credit. Played very well. Scored the goals they needed to score. Pushed it to extra time. And in the end, they got through. The Europa League round of 16 draw is out as well. Everton destroyed Young Boys yesterday. They now move on to face Dynamo Kiev. You have Zenit St. Petersburg against Torino. Villarreal and Sevilla. Club Bruges of Belgium against Besiktas. Dnipro. I'm not going to say it, Trevor. Dnipro. I'm just going to go with Dnipro. Against Ajax. Wolfsburg, who is now the bookies' favorite to win the competition, against Inter Milan. That's pretty tasty right there. Napoli, Dynamo Moscow, and Fiorentina and Roma going up against each other in the last 16 of the Europa League. And remember, I just said it, but remember, winner of this competition gets themselves into the Champions League next year, regardless of their league finish. Jack Wilshere's Arsenal return has been delayed. He had a minor procedure on his ankle and will be delayed for a couple more weeks. This is not good news for Arsenal, obviously coming off of their own troubling first leg against Monaco at the Emirates. Going back into the Premier League this coming weekend, they need everything they can get. They need everybody that they can muster. And Jack Wilshere has been in and out of the lineup so often over the last couple of years. It's a running joke for me that he's always hurt. But I certainly want to see him play. He's a talented young player. As I mentioned, the DC United fell to Alajuelense 5-2 in Costa Rica in the CONCACAF Champions League last night. Just not in rhythm, DC United. Certainly you have to put some of this on Andrew Dykstra, spilling some shots he probably shouldn't have. By all reports, unlike him to do that. But everybody's in preseason form for MLS. This will continue to be an issue in this competition. When the MLS teams make it this far, they are not ready to play against teams that have been... Alajuelense had something like 11 games in the last 40 days. DC United hasn't played in 110 days. You go into that environment in Costa Rica, and it's not a recipe for success. Certainly not with the way that MLS prepares their teams financially. And maybe that'll come up later in the show when we talk to Dave Zirin. There you go. Let's set this up. Darryl Lovell. From Houston, MLS beat writer for the Houston Dynamo will talk to us about the preparations for the 2015 season there. Owen Coyle's adaptation to MLS. Don't go anywhere. It's Soccer Morning, brought to you by World Soccer Talk. Facing the crowd.
Welcome back to Soccer Morning on Backheel.com with Jason Davis.
Here we go. Soccer Morning brought to you by World Soccer Talk. And I've been corrected on my Curt Flood history. And I'm a baseball guy, so this is probably inexcusable. But Jeff is telling me that Curt didn't win his free agency that came later on. He certainly sued for his free agency. He sued for the right to to choose his team. But that's neither here nor there, because Daryl Lovell is on the line from Houston to talk about the Dynamo and their upcoming 2015 season. Daryl, how are you, sir?
I can't complain, Jason. Thanks for having me on.
It's I imagine it's nice and warm in Houston. It's cold where I am, but when it's...
It is not nice and warm here, sir.
Okay, give me
32 degrees here.
Oh, that is pretty chilly for Houston. Does that mean like your houses crumble and people are running around the streets not knowing what to do?
Now, coming from somebody who went to school in Colorado and Missouri, they actually delayed school the other day because it could frost.
Oh, no.
And there was the possibility of ice. I just laughed.
All right. Well, meanwhile, the Houston Dynamo are preparing for a new season. First, you'll have to tell me. I'm not tracking everybody's whereabouts, Daryl, but you have to tell me where the Dynamo have prepared, what kind of trips they've been on, and whether or not whether or not this is a very different sort of Dynamo camp, considering it's the first one without Dom Kinnear.
Well, first, they've been to Arizona, and they're actually currently in Charleston right now. As far as whether it's been a different camp, it's really the drills are different. I think the mood. I think there's a little more of a focus on getting the guys to do some more fun things. You know, somebody I was talking to last week, they were doing one-on-one drills, and we were standing on the side and watching it, and he goes, yeah, that's just sneaky fitness.
Right.
You know, so I think that's the difference. To be honest, though, it's a lot of the same faces on the player side, even a few of the same coaches, a few of the same guys behind the scene. I mean, Coyle is obviously different. It's much more difficult to understand the coaches at training.
That's what I was going to ask.
Because of the accents.
I was going to go right there. I was going to go, do these guys sometimes pause because they're not quite sure what Owen's asking for?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story I heard. It was one of the first days of training, and apparently Sandy Stewart, who's Owen Coyle's longtime right-hand man, who's Scottish himself, and it's a much tougher Scottish accent than Coyle's is, he apparently asked Boniek Garcia if he was Honduran. And Boniek looked at him and smiled and said, no. And then he came over and asked while I was standing there, he goes, I thought you said Boniek was Honduran. And he goes, and we kind of said, yes, he is. And he goes, well, he told me he's not. And we told him, well, he probably doesn't understand what you're saying.
Yeah, there might be a bit of a language barrier on both sides for that. I'm not sure how good Boniak's English is. It's probably decent, but wait, come on, Scottish people, they flummoxed us all. Speaking of flummoxed, this league has a reputation for punishing foreign managers, Daryl. Guys come in and, every now and then we have one with some reasonable success. I'm thinking about Osorio. I'm thinking about Baca in New York. Obviously we've had some crash and burn moments. Is there a sense that Owen Coyle's of a different cut of cloth, that he is going to be able to handle this a little bit better? Certainly he knows some American players from his time in England.
Well, and I think two things give him an advantage. I'll say that. I don't know if he's cut from a different cloth, because we're not going to know that until June or July, to be honest. But I think there's two things that work in his advantage. A, as you mentioned, he has a lot of experience with American players. He's spent a lot of time scouting America. For him, I think that's an advantage. Not only does he get used to the players, but he sees the game. He understands the game and MLS, which I think that will give him a little bit of a leg up on some of the other coaches that come in. And also, he's regularly brought his teams here when he was coaching in England for the summer for their preseason. He would spend 2 or 3 weeks in the U.S. and he really, talking to people, I wrote a story on a feature on him this week, and talking to people around him, he really did fall in love with American soccer, I'm going to call it the American soccer way, the fan, the want to get to grow the game. Then he really likes MLS. Mm-hmm. To be honest with you, he really likes the way the game has progressed here. I think he favors the more physical style, not just physical being, the fouling, but the actual physicality, the athleticism in MLS. I think he really likes that. So I think just kind of being familiar gives him a leg up, but we can say all we want. And I've said this a couple of times, a couple of different people who really want to get on the Owen Coyle bandwagon. We're not going to know if all of this works until July or August.
I imagine
it's going to be an interesting look.
Yeah, I imagine he had to convince the brass down there that he was going to be different, that he was going to be a guy who fully embraced all of the quirks that are MLS. We don't expect Owen Coyle to come out in June or July and start complaining about his roster and not being able to add to it the way he wants to, or having to trade away rights or a player or a draft pick in order to bolster things, are we?
No, and to be fair, I think, you're right. You're right on that point. When they were going through the first off, they didn't really think Owen Coyle would be interested in the job, considering the offers and considering the rumors behind the scenes that he was getting in the meetings he was having. But when he expressed interest in the job, their first hesitancy was, will this guy come in and understand MLS and play the rules game? And like you said, is he going to complain in August that he can't go out and just buy a striker? That he can't go out and just buy a defender.
Right.
And he's been pretty adamant that he understands those rules. He understands the idea of the salary cap. And him and to be fair, that's why you hire Matt Jordan.
Right.
You hire Matt Jordan, a guy with MLS experience who has a pretty good scouting network, and you make sure those guys can work together. And during the hiring process, they hired Matt before they hired Owen. A big part of that process, for Owen at least, was making sure that him and Matt Jordan meshed very well. So you hope that's not going to be the case. Again, losing four games in a row changes a lot of things.
Let's talk about the roster a bit. This, to me, it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of change here. This is essentially last year's team with the potential. I mean, obviously, the arrival of Kubo Torres pending. What else has changed? What else is different? Do you expect Owen Coyle to transition them into a different look than maybe Dominic Kinnear played?
No, I really don't. I mean, hold on. I don't think they're going to look very different. You're probably going to see one different starter on opening day this year, or I should say two, because Tyler Derrick will be in goal where Tally Hall was last year. But Tyler ended the season last year as a starter. And Raul Rodriguez, the rest of the lineup will be guys that everybody knows. It's not going to be much different. They're going to come in. Maybe Giles Barnes slots in underneath Will Bruin a little more. But it's going to be the same four-man midfield, two forward, maybe a forward and an off forward. It's going to be very similar, though, to what they did last year as far as the tactics and the formation is concerned. I think the difference is what they're being asked to do. They're being asked to play with the ball more. They're being asked to look for more opportunities to run at people. Instead of playing the two- and three-touch soccer, they're being asked to create something in the midfield and spark an attack more than look for opportunities. You know, the more than just get it wide and get up the field and get it in the box. And that was always Dominic Kinnear's mantra. When all else fails, play outside in. And I think Coyle's going to ask them to vary that up a little more. And I think, and you hope that that's going to spark the attack. But truthfully, when you watch them, the personnel is the same. They look the same because the personnel is the same. And you can tell a player all you want, hey, do this.
Yeah.
When the game starts, that player is going to do what they know how to do best. Brad Davis is going to push to the line and send a cross in.
Right.
Bolian Garcia is going to cut in. So I got a feeling it's not going to look a lot different, but there are some different ideas being asked of them, some different things being asked of them.
Well, you obviously have a core of players who have been together for a while and know each other and are going to play in a certain way. So perhaps Coyle's mandate here is to get the best out of them, and they're going to need that, Daryl, moving over to the Western Conference. Whether or not the East is far behind the West in terms of direct competition, if you look at last year's records, it's not that. I don't think it's a major difference, but we certainly see the West as a deeper conference. And remember, this is a team that didn't make the playoffs in the East last year. With all of that said, what are the expectations? I mean, again, you've got Seattle and LA and Real Salt Lake and all of these teams, Portland, who should be back on a decent run. How is Houston going to climb into that top echelon?
You could be the eighth best team in the MLS and still miss the playoffs in the West. I mean, you really can. Even if they're taking six this year, it's just a huge step up. The expectation is the playoffs. I'm not altogether sure that's a realistic expectation. I would put them in a group of maybe three to four teams that will look to squeeze out one of those final two playoffs. I think if you look, there's the top four teams in the West right now. You're probably looking at Seattle, LA, Kansas City, and probably Real Salt Lake. And everybody else is fighting for those last two spots. They're going to have to figure out a way to score goals, A. And I had said it coming into the season, you can score all the goals you want, but if you give up 58 goals in an MLS season, you're not going anywhere.
Right, right.
And they gave up 58 goals last year, so they need to figure out how to keep teams off the board. Jermaine Taylor looks better this year in preseason than he has the last couple of years. And if Rodriguez is as good as they think he is, I think that's how they get there. They have to, for everything we want to talk about with going forward and creating and all this stuff, they have got to get back to stopping people. If they stop teams in the West, I think that's their best path to the playoffs. Because in an arms race, until Kubo Torres gets here, I just don't see them outscoring teams.
Yeah, you know,
not in the West.
I don't think, Daryl, with Owen Coyle coming in and with the legacy of Dom Kinnear, we would expect Houston to suddenly become the type of team that knocks it around the park, that looks for those intricate movements at the top of the box. They're going to muck it up. They're going to have to muck it up a little bit. Look for Brad Davis to hit those crosses. And as you said, last year it wasn't necessarily the attack, although, you know, that maybe wasn't good enough. But it was defending that was the ultimate problem. So you're convinced, or the team is convinced, and maybe Coyle thinks he can move some pieces around or maybe change a responsibility or two to shore that up?
Am I convinced? No. And I've actually asked this question a couple of times. Did the team, I've asked this of Matt Jordan and Chris Kennedy and Owen Coyle, did the team do enough this year to shore up the defense? They're all very confident that an improvement, and to be fair, to be honest with them, Jermaine Taylor does look much better this preseason than he has the last couple of preseasons. And to be, I think that's maybe a big difference with Owen. I think a lot of players have a little more of a fresh look to them now that the regime has changed a little bit. And I don't think it's a negative on Dom. I just think the same message after a while just kind of loses its effect on some guys. Mm-hmm. So guys like Jermaine Taylor, a guy like maybe Alex Lopez in attack, they look a little fresher. But they seem very confident that adding Raul Rodriguez and a better Jermaine Taylor with Tyler Derrick, if he can play at the level they know he can, that they can stop people. And you got to remember, they're going to have a full season of Luis Garrido and Rico Clark, or hoping to have a full season of Luis Garrido and Rico Clark in front of them. That's going to take a lot of pressure off of that back line that was absolutely there in the first part of last season.
Well, I mean, you say that, but I think doesn't there have to be some concern that you know, we might see Rico go down again, that you could see some of these?
No, that's why I said the hope is they're going to have these guys for a full season. You're going to miss Garrido for the Gold Cup at least. So you've got to figure out the back line is still the issue. The back line is still the big question mark going into the season. Have they addressed it? To be fair, looking at the preseason game, and they're just preseason games, but Raul Rodriguez does look like a very good defender. So I think they made a good signing there. The question is, was the back line's issues last year just talent-oriented, or was there maybe a cohesion problem? You know, you'll have DeMarcus Beasley for a whole season, or presumably for a whole season this year. If they can get on the same page and they can run the same defense out there week in and week out in a relative fashion, you got to think that the improvement will come. Will it be enough of an improvement in the West? Yeah, I don't know. Where I'm skeptical.
There's age at some crucial spots here, Daryl. I don't, you know, you rely on Brad Davis. Okay, fine. I expect him to be very good as well. You know, as always, Rico Clark. Okay, maybe an injury concern. He's sturdy. Defensive midfielder. Beasley, as you said, I mean, he's getting up there. You know, it could be very easily be the type of season where he's dealing with some stuff. I hope not, but you have to manage his minutes. Let me get to the elephant in the room for the Dynamo, and as you already mentioned it, they're going to have to get to Kubo. Now, maybe Kubo doesn't change things dramatically, and maybe he's not the savior. You certainly don't want to set him up to have to be the savior of the team, but a lot of eyes are going to be on the Dynamo between now and Kubo's arrival, whenever that is, and maybe you have a word on that, because he can be such an offensive force. And then you have to wonder, okay, who sits down? I mean, what happens with Bruin? What happens with Boniac Garcia? What happens with Giles Barnes? I mean, you expect them all to be in the lineup, but you have to shuffle those pieces.
I don't expect Bruin to be in the lineup when Kubo Torres gets here.
Okay, fair enough.
I think that's the guy who is, if you're looking for the guy that comes in. Now, can Will Bruin score 12 goals between now and when Kubo Torres arrives and force his hand? Absolutely. But Will Bruin, until Kubo Torres gets here, is playing, essentially, in my opinion, is playing for a spot. He's playing for minutes once the change is made. Now, when Torres gets here, we don't know, because if he doesn't get here before May 13th, then they have to wait for the window to reopen in July, when he could also be gone on Gold Cup duty.
Right.
Yeah. So there is a scenario out there where this guy may not get to Houston until August. I mean, there's not a whole lot of certainty. Now, there are according to Chris Kinnear, there are some ways that the deal, the loan deal, could be ended earlier. Not he's not going to tell us that. He's not going to tell us what the intricate details of the contract are. But there are ways to end that deal earlier. But until Kubo, I mean, banking on Kubo Tour this season, in my opinion, is not the best option. It's not the best strategy. They're going to have to figure out how to get the most out of these guys. And like you said, there is a lot of age there. Brad Davis, while he's in great shape, not getting any younger. Even Bonier Garcia, that guy has logged a lot of minutes the last couple of years in international play in MLS. You got Beasley. I think there are some very real concerns here. And the depth is what failed them last year. Mm. Will the depth hold up this year? Because it's going to, every team's depth has to hold up. So it'll have to hold up when it's called upon.
I want to talk, since you had an eye on the Dynamo, certainly when they've been in town, you may have had the opportunity to talk about this. I want to get to maybe any thoughts you've heard about the CBA. But very quickly before I do that, do you get the sense that Coyle's got a pretty long leash here, that if they finish bottom three in the conference, that he's going to be around next year?
Bottom three in the conference, I think he'll be around next year regardless.
Okay.
I'll say that.
Fair enough.
Bottom three would probably force them to have some real conversations. Would force them to have some real conversations. But I don't think Coyle comes here, A, and I don't think they make the investment in the team, B, if this was going to be, you better produce now or you're out as of January 1st, 2016.
Okay. What if you,
I think he's got some time.
What have you heard around the Dynamo, maybe from players or whatever? I mean, certainly don't want you to out anybody here with the sensitive nature of it, but what have you heard about the CBA negotiations and sort of the feeling around the Dynamo as this deadline approaches?
You kind of get the feeling that everybody is, I think this time more than last time, I think people are ready for the worst that I can remember. At least around here, the idea is leaning more towards, just from the people I talk to, the idea is leaning more towards a strike is a much higher possibility. This go around, it just doesn't sound, from the people I've talked to, it just doesn't sound like the union is really budging on the issue. Now, this information is about a week old, because they've been in Charleston the whole time. I haven't really had a whole lot of access to them, but it really does sound to me, at least the feeling here is that the MLS, the owners, are just not budging very much. And they're starting to play some of the negotiating tactics with the players' union. They really are playing hardball on the free agency idea. In my opinion, I'm talking to people here, strike is a much bigger option or a much more realistic option than I had thought previously before talking to those people.
Daryl, you may have to pass the time during the strike writing stories about the guys who are surviving on ramen. And I mean, not that that's...
I'll be one of them. If they don't play, we don't get paid.
Okay, MLS and the players, get this done. Daryl Lovell needs his job. Daryl Lovell, MLSsoccer.com beat writer. Follow him on Twitter. It's Daryl with two R's and two L's and Lovell with one V and two L's, if I got that right.
You have that right there.
There you go. Appreciate the time, Daryl. Thanks a lot.
Anytime, bro. Right.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to grab Thomas Floyd from Goal, talk a little DC United, their failures in the Champions League, perhaps their preparations for 2015. Soccer Morning, World Soccer Talk. Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back.
Welcome back to Soccer Morning on Backheel.com with Jason Davis.
Back on Soccer Morning, brought to you by World Soccer Talk. This music just feels like Thomas Floyd.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, Thomas Floyd 10 on Twitter, writer at Goal, and one of the three fantastic co-hosts of Open Wide for Some Soccer, which you can find at Backheel.com. Thomas, how are you on a Friday?
I'm pretty good. Still trying to process what happened last night. Don't know if I'll
really
completely understand it.
Really? You're trying to process an MLS team going to Central America and getting throttled in the preseason? That's what you're trying to process?
It's not that I'm necessarily shocked by what happened. It's kind of trying to figure out all the different factors that led to that.
Okay, well, give me your list, your top three factors that led to DC United falling 5-2 to Alajuelense last night in Costa Rica.
All right, I'll start with kind of the cliche of the staging of the competition. Everyone knows that having the knockout round in MLS preseason is fairly crippling to the MLS teams. That said, Montreal went down to Mexico and got a result, so it's not impossible. I don't think the turf helped United. They didn't really seem to be able to have any control of the ball on that playing surface. I know Ben Olsen before the game was pretty concerned about having that narrow field and that bouncy turf and how United would handle that. And then also you just have that Andrew Dykstra performance, which really can't be sugarcoated. If Bill Hamid is in there and turns in a typical Bill Hamid performance, this is a game that's probably maybe a 2-2 draw, maybe goes maybe a one goal loss. It can go very differently, but that was just a very, very rough performance from Dykstra, who granted was playing his first game back from a pretty bad Achilles injury.
How many of those goals do you lay at Dykstra's feet or hands?
The penalty kick for sure. He has a player who's going away from goal, and you know, there's really no danger in that situation. He makes a poor decision and puts the referee in a tough spot where I think that was the right call. Obviously the one where he bobbles the service into the box and it falls right to an attacker's feet is on him. The other ones maybe he could have done better, but those are the two that I think really, when you look at them, Dykstra will want to have them back.
As for the performance of the rest of the team, I mean, clearly, again, as you said, team in preseason, maybe they got an early start to their preparations because they knew this was coming. There's only so much you can do. Those training matches, going to Texas, playing for their armadillo, they really can't replicate what you're going to see in these games. How did you assess the rest of the team and maybe, you know, even pick apart Olsen's choices for starting lineup?
I do think they missed Marcus Halsty, which is kind of an odd thing to say because he's the newcomer. He's the player who you figure if he has an injury, well, let's just trot out the 11 guys who were so successful last year. But Halsty is this veteran player. He played in the UEFA Champions League just this past fall, started 6 games in the group stage. And I think he's the type of guy whose composure really would have helped in that midfield or in the back line. He can play center back or holding midfield. He was out with a minor injury, so you really can't argue too much with the lineup they put out there because Olsen, he went with the players who were so successful last year with the Boswell-Birnbaum center back pairing and that Kitchen-Arnaud central midfield duo. But that's the part of the field where they just got overrun. Kitchen-Arnaud saw almost none of the ball. It was a very uncharacteristic performance from those players. And then Boswell and Birnbaum just weren't on the same page. And perhaps that's because Birnbaum was in national team camp for a big chunk of preseason and then missed a couple weeks with that minor knee injury he suffered with the U.S. But you still would think after they started, 17, 18, 19 games together last season, that those two would have more chemistry than they did last night.
Well, let's not forget that Steve Birnbaum is a second-year player at this point, and he doesn't have any second-year experience yet because the season hasn't started. So, you know, to elevate, yeah, he had a strong finish to 2014, but sort of elevate him to a spot where he's going to be consistently a very good central defender, especially in an environment like that, that he's never seen before, I think is probably a bit too far, right?
Yeah, I agree. I do think the stock of Steve Birnbaum has gone up very quickly.
Maybe outpaced how good he actually is. And that's not a slight on him, but sometimes we do this thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, that's no criticism of Birnbaum at all, but he goes from being a rookie who didn't play a single minute in the first half of last season before Jeff Park's injury to being a solid starter alongside Boswell, who people will remember was a Defender of the Year finalist. And then he's in national team camp starting and getting this praise from Klinsmann. I'm sure it's all very warranted, but maybe his status is kind of being this unflappable player who has done so well and limited opportunities so far, maybe people are getting ahead of themselves. And last night we saw some of the growing pains that maybe United fans you know, should prepare themselves for in his second season.
This is going to sound harsh on DC United, Thomas, and I just can't avoid it. I'm sorry. But this, you know, we came into this week with these Champions League matches coming up for Montreal and DC, and it just didn't seem like this was going to be MLS's year, even less so than it usually does. When you got the Galaxy in this round or some of the Seattle, perhaps, you might give them a shot. These two teams, despite DC United finishing first in the East last year, just don't seem built to compete at this level in this environment in the preseason with all of the things that are happening. Again, you know, whether or not Eddie Johnson is a crucial point of part of DC United at this point, and he didn't finish the year as a major player except when injuries came up, it's still, you know, it's still a piece and a highly paid piece that they didn't have available.
Yeah, Eddie Johnson also was very successful in CCL last fall. Those were the games where he was getting goals and getting on the board and contributing and using his athleticism to, you know, win those matchups against, you know, perhaps some of the smaller defenders you'll see when you play these Central American teams. So he, you know, to be honest, on DC United's depth chart, he's probably their number four forward at this point. They have Fabian Espíndola, Chris Pontius, and if he's healthy, Luis Silva. But he would be very useful in a game like this, and it is another tough blow for United that they didn't have him or Luis Silva available as at least options off the bench in that game.
Before I go to Espíndola and Silva and maybe the performance of De Leon last night, is it common knowledge what Eddie's situation is right now? I don't want to say anything. I mean, I've heard some stuff, but I don't want to say anything if this isn't something that either the team or Eddie wants publicized.
The team has continued to say it's an undisclosed medical issue.
Okay.
If you look into some of the things Eddie has said, last fall he said he was hospitalized with an issue perhaps related to having an enlarged heart, and I think that's what people have concluded this is related to.
Okay.
But the team has not confirmed it, so at this point it remains a little bit of guesswork as to exactly what the issue is.
I don't know, and you know, medical stuff that is outside of the usual athletically caused injuries is maybe a little tougher to handle. But if this was a knee injury, let's just assume that the heart is a thing that Eddie's still dealing with. If this was a knee injury, we'd be talking about, okay, it's 6 weeks out, it's 2 months out. He's got a rehab. He's got to come back. They're going to get him at this point in the season. This is something that really we have no idea. This could be it for Eddie Johnson. I'm not wishing that on him, but certainly this could be it for Eddie Johnson. How does DC United, again, it's not just about whether he's the fourth or fifth forward option, which he might be. It's also that he's taking up a big chunk of their salary cap right now.
Right, and he has not trained at all in preseason, and in fact, he has been purposely deconditioned, as Ben Olsen put it, for some of the tests. So if he does come back, if everything is clear, he is completely starting from scratch from a fitness perspective, so he still would not be back for at least a few weeks, probably over a month, if we found out today that he's okay. So DC United does have to deal without Eddie Johnson, without that big chunk of the salary cap, and that's tough for them because this is a team that is operating, you know, they don't have a huge budget. Fabian Espíndola is the only other DP on the roster, and he's a DP they just upgraded to that status during this past offseason. So to not have such a big chunk of the cap, that hurts for United.
Yeah, it seems like maybe DC United just, you know, again, they had some success last year. Olsen did a fantastic job with that team. Birnbaum, emerged as a quality defender. Perry Kitchen got better. He had a career year or close to it from Davey Arnault. Those things all came together to get them into first place last season. They didn't make their goal, clearly, but you still feel like they're in a holding pattern until that stadium gets built down on Buzzard Point. And I guess looking at DC United and looking at this campaign, and correct me if I'm wrong, Thomas, they're not going to get any of that extra allocation money this year because they didn't win the U.S. Open Cup last year as they did in 2013, and their Champions League campaign, they got that allocation money last season, correct?
I do believe they get allocation money for this fall's Champions League.
Right. Okay. Yes. They qualified for that. Yes. Okay. So you do have a little bit of relief there. Have you heard from Olsen or anybody else at the team, maybe at the coaching level? Cause I don't imagine management would really speak out on this, but have you heard from them and his attitude about how prepared MLS teams are in general to go into this competition. He seems like the kind of guy who might be a little honest, more honest than others, about the issues MLS faces when they have to go down to Costa Rica or go down to Mexico and play teams with much bigger budgets that are in the middle of their seasons.
Yeah, Ben Olsen talked about it a good bit about a month ago at the beginning of season media availability. And of course, at the time, he spoke a lot of optimism for United because of the continuity they had in the roster. A lot of these MLS teams are, you know, like Montreal, ironically, are coming into the Champions League knockout stage after overhauling their rosters, and new players are still coming together. Whereas United, they understand each other. They have that chemistry. So it's that was one point he brought up. But he noted that MLS teams have done poorly in this competition, and he knows that, and he knows about the obstacles they face. He does say CONCACAF has improved a lot of the more subtle aspects of Champions League that MLS teams have complained about in the past, such as when United played a Waterhouse in the group stage. It was played at Jamaica's national stadium as opposed to being played at Waterhouse's home venue. So, yeah, Olsen, you know, he kind of went through this with a glass half full perspective. He was pleased with what CONCACAF has done to make this competition more palatable for MLS teams and give them a better chance. But when it comes to the budget differences, ultimately there's not much CONCACAF can do about that. So it remains a tough road for any MLS team.
So I'll do with you what I did with Daryl Lovell down in Houston just a couple of minutes ago and ask you if you've heard anything, if you've heard any rumblings or talked to any players about the current situation with the CBA. Again, not necessarily to out anybody. I don't know if there's – is Boswell part of leadership? So is there anybody who's actively talking about where the players stand and the fact that MLS refuses to budge on free agency?
Yes, Bobby Boswell spoke to media a couple weeks ago when United had their brief stop in D.C. between their Florida and Texas training stints. And the thing that really stuck out that I'm sure you probably saw in Pablo Maurer's MLS soccer piece was that he said that he was preparing his teammates in Houston for a strike 2 years ago, that this is something that's been a long time coming from the players' perspective. They knew this would be a battle and that they seem really set to fight for free agency, and that this isn't something that they're probably going to cave on at the last minute to avoid a strike, that the players are prepared for a work stoppage if it comes to that, and that they think their free agency demands are perfectly reasonable. They're not asking for all out free agency. They're asking for some sort of limited free agency that would be dependent on, you know, MLS service, how many games you've played, how many years you've been in the league. It would only be open to certain players. So from the players' union perspective, they think this is reasonable. They're prepared to strike for it. And that's kind of the message Boswell was putting out to media when he spoke a couple weeks ago.
Do you believe this has any impact on how well they prepare, not just for the Champions League, but how well they're preparing for the season? I mean, if that's in the back of your mind, if there's no progress, if everything you're hearing out of the negotiations is that MLS is just staring back across the table at the players, refusing to even address the issue, don't you think that creeps into some of these guys' heads about whether or not they'll be ready on March 7th?
I'm sure it does. What I'll say is these players are focused, and I think they've done a good job from everything I've heard of really focusing on this preseason and kind of just taking it one training session at a time, one game at a time, to use the cliches, and kind of controlling what they can control on the field and letting the off the field stuff kind of resolve itself over time, hopefully. So it could have been a factor perhaps in last night in terms of their preparation, but ultimately I'd probably put that pretty far down the list of things that contributed to that performance.
All right, Thomas is a guy who covers this league week in and week out, all year round, 365 days a year. Just your gut, are we gonna see a stoppage?
My gut is that something would get done very last minute. Okay. But
does that require the players to cave, though?
Probably, okay. To an extent. I what I'm still waiting for is some sort of thorough explanation from the league as to why why they find free agency completely untenable in a league where there's a salary cap. I wonder if at some point that'll come up.
Don't hold your breath, Thomas. That's all I'd ask. We can't lose you. Don't hold your breath, man. It's not going to happen. Thomas Floyd from goal.com and open wide for some soccer. Follow him on Twitter. It's ThomasFloyd10. Thomas, thanks for your insight. We'll get you back very soon.
All right, thanks for having me.
All right, there you go. Let's take a break when we come back. I'm going to open up the phone lines for a little bit before we get to Dave Zirin at 11 o'clock and talk about the work stoppage that may be coming in MLS. This is Soccer Morning, brought to you by World Soccer Talk. Don't go anywhere. Be right back.
It be feeling like the life that I'm living, man, I don't control. Every day I'm in a fight for my soul. Could it be that my medicine's the evidence for pigs to stop and frisk me when they rolling around on patrol?
Welcome back to Soccer Morning on Backheel.com with Jason Davis.
Here we go, back on Soccer Morning, brought to you by World Soccer Talk. Little quick call-in segment for you. 3-4-3-5-3-5. Why am I blanking on the phone number right now? 347-756-6276. 347-756-6276. That's your phone number to jump on board Soccer Morning. We can talk about this CBA situation. I'll tell you what I've been distracted by in the last couple of minutes watching my Twitter feed. Rob Harris at the Associated Press has now filed a story this morning outlining the scale of racism and discrimination in Russia. Obviously, this matters because the 2018 World Cup, which is 3.5 years away, people, is in Russia. The lead here from Rob Harris: Russian football is plagued by a racist and far-right extremist fan culture that threatens the safety of visitors to the 2018 World Cup, a report provided to the Associated Press reveals. Researchers from the Moscow-based Sova Center and the FAIR Network, which helps to prosecute racism for racism cases for European football's governing body UEFA, highlighted more than 200 cases of discriminatory behavior linked to Russian football over two seasons. 200 in two seasons. That's not a little bit. That's not a trickle. That's not a couple of isolated incidents. That's a culture unto itself. Washington's on the line. What's up?
Hey, what's up, Jason? Listen, I'm a huge fan of the league and of the sport, but I have to admit, when it comes to the business, sometimes I get a little hazy. I'm trying to understand this possible work stoppage and the exact definition of what is free agency and why the players want it and why the league doesn't. Can you give me like a for dummies version, a quick version of it?
What is free agency? Free agency is when you're Go ahead.
Right. So why do the players want it but MLS doesn't? I kind of want to understand that.
All right. Let's try to do this in remedial fashion. The players want it because when their contract is up, they don't feel like they should be tied to their previous team. If they don't have a contract, they feel as though they should have the right to go sign whatever they want. So if a contract runs out under the current system, the team they played for holds their rights. And in order for them to move to a different city, their rights have to be traded. So if Sporting has a player, contract runs out, the player says, I have other offers or I have other interests. New York wants me. DC wants me. New England wants me. They want the ability to be able to choose between those cities and those offers. Whereas under the current system, MLS does not allow that. Now, the reason that MLS does not allow that is because they don't want their teams competing against each other for players, because that'll drive up salaries. If you have New York and New England going for the same player, you'll get a bidding war. MLS is built on the notion that bidding wars are the worst thing to ever happen to sports, period. That's how they act, okay? So that's why the league continues to be intransigent on this issue, is because they not only do they not want bidding wars from a monetary standpoint, because it may drive up salaries to a certain extent, but they also don't want a bidding war because then it indicates that the league has 20 individual teams operating on 20 individual interests
instead of single entity.
There you go, Washington.
I get you. Thanks a lot.
Right, no problem. There you go. Let's 908. You're on the air.
Hey, Jason. It's Steve from New Jersey. How
What's going
you?
On, Steve?
I'm guessing you follow Sepp Blatter on Twitter, but do you think he's helping? Do you think he's helping his cause at all by tweeting out that we have to stop racism and everything and, you know, present a concrete plan for tackling discrimination in 2018 for the World Cup?
Is he helping his cause
or just people are just getting pissed at him because of what's happening in Qatar as well?
Well, okay. Do you lay Qatar at the feet of Sepp Blatter? I think it's fair to because he's overseeing everything. He's created the culture that led to that decision, even if he wasn't going to vote for them or didn't vote for them when that World Cup was handed out. I think he's in this situation, and I'm no Sepp Blatter fan, obviously, but I think in this situation he's a little damned if he does and damned if he doesn't. If he doesn't say anything, it's why aren't you addressing this issue or this thing that's happening in Russia or the racism that's happening in Europe? If he does address it, then we all take a cynical viewpoint that he's just trying to, he's trying to bolster his own image. So I don't know that there's any particular way for Sepp Blatter to do it that doesn't smack of incompetence. I don't know.
So, I mean, he's addressing that there are issues within soccer for racism and everything, but he still is not addressing the 800-pound gorilla about what's going on in Qatar, about people dying
every 2 days.
He's not helping a cause, I believe.
I don't know if these words came out of his mouth. Thanks for the call, Steve. I don't know if these words came out of his mouth directly or if they came out of the mouth of one of his lackeys, but the stance that FIFA took was that's not our concern, that's not something we should be involved. World football should not be involved in the question of poor conditions for migrant laborers in Qatar. That's insanity, and that's passing the buck, and that's ignoring, as Steve said, the elephant in the room. But that's where they're sitting right now. That's why it's so troubling. And look, Milan Jarr on Twitter: racism and war in Russia, but everyone is more worried about the heat in Qatar 2022. Hello. Think there isn't some racism in that? There may be some racism in the fact that people are focused on Qatar more than Russia. But we have been adamant around here of trying to keep some of the focus on the issues that face Russia 2018. The fact that you have an authoritarian government run by a man with expansionist ideas that is creating a war situation in Ukraine. Whether you believe it's a civil war or a Russian war of aggression, it doesn't matter. Russia's involved. These issues that I just highlighted in this AP report, 200 issues of racism and discriminatory behavior over the last 2 years, insane. 347, you're on the air.
Hey, Jason. I checked out the podcast and my first time watching the live show. Kudos to you because the production is really impressive.
I appreciate that. Thanks.
Happy to see that.
That's giving Trevor Hayward some love, and he appreciates that, I'm sure.
Well, love to Trevor then. Love to Trevor. Right. I want you to go a little lighter topic here. I'm in New York, and we're seeing 14,000 season tickets sold by New York City SC.
Okay.
What do you make of this? Is this, by my estimation, successful, even though there's been so much negative press? Are we too close to it? Are we making more of a bigger deal of Lampard and the supporters club?
Well, look, I mean, I've picked on NYCFC, and I've certainly gotten flack from new fans on that issue. I think that the team has made some missteps, Lampard being the biggest one, but some other things as well. But 14,000 season tickets, you can't sneeze at that. You really can't. Now, I will go back, and my major criticism of the situation as it exists is that MLS handed this franchise to a team or to a group that did not have a clear path to a stadium and still doesn't. And we're talking about New York City and the land situation in that part of the world being very, very difficult, and who knows how long it'll be. And playing in a baseball stadium for more than 2 or 3 years is a very bad situation. Those things I put on MLS. I don't put that on NYCFC or their fans. I'm glad to see that there's enthusiasm. 14,000 season tickets. You're right. We absolutely should celebrate that. Even as we are right to criticize some of the public relations disasters the team has had and MLS for setting up a team in New York City that may or may not actually have a long-term future there.
Yeah, I think anybody would have signed up for that before. If you would have said 14,000 to start, you know, I'm not even sure what the Red Bulls base is, but they've got to be looking at that number and being a little bit concerned. And I just don't know if the fans who are coming out are so in tune with the issue that, you know, everybody who covers and the writers and the MLS beat writers are really focusing on. Maybe they just want to see soccer.
I suppose that, look, we all have to, we have to, thanks for the call, man, I got to go, but we've got to distract ourselves during the off season, and now we've also got the potential of a work stoppage, of labor strife going into the season carrying over. Of course we're going to get worked up about these other things. And I'm not close enough to New York to have, you know, to be stepping out in talking about the team as it relates to the media relations. But I have we've had Howard Megdal on this show. We've talked there are certainly people out there, Michael Lewis up in New York, who are suggesting the team's not doing enough on that front as well. And these are things that you can't take for granted. Let's take a break. When we come back, I'm going to talk to Dave Zirin about a potential MLS work stoppage. And in the context of American sports, how will other people view this? How should we as soccer fans view this? Don't go anywhere. Soccer Morning, brought to you by World Soccer Talk. Be right back.
Welcome back to Soccer Morning on Backheel.com with Jason Davis.
Here we go, back on Soccer Morning, brought to you by World Soccer Talk. I'm on the phone. Well, yeah, I'm on the phone now. We had some issues. Skype phone. Dave Zirin, Edge of Sports on Twitter, sports editor at The Nation, which is where he has a piece on the MLS labor situation. Hi, Dave.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for having me. And as you said, up air, the phone gives it that real radio feel. So we're just going to roll with it.
Absolutely. All right, Dave. So you've written a piece at The Nation on the MLS labor situation and the potential for a player strike. And I think the central question for soccer fans here, and obviously we're very close to this, and we understand all of the issues involved and why the players are asking for what they want, and why the owners may be holding out or less understanding, but certainly we see their viewpoint. The question is whether or not this is ultimately going to be a major problem for Major League Soccer, if it's going to have a debilitating effect on the sport. From your perspective and from the people you've talked to, do you see it as one of those things that becomes, you know, potentially damaging to the future growth?
Well, it's so interesting because that's always been the way we've talked about sports labor disputes. And people always point back to the 1994 lockout strike in Major League Baseball, because that was both a lockout and a strike. Actually started as a strike, ended as a lockout. And it took years for Major League Baseball and a whole hell of a lot of steroids for them to return to national prominence in the late 90s. But I think we're in a kind of a new paradigm in the 21st century, and you saw this with the NHL losing an entire season. It's like there could be some very short-term pain for MLS, but if the players win, and by win, I mean win free agency, which I would argue is a prerequisite for Major League Soccer becoming the sport and league that it could become,
right,
it could be possible that we see short-term pain, long-term gain, and a much better chance to reach Don Garber's own words, his goal, to have MLS be one of the best leagues in the world by 2022.
You know, Dave, this is one of those things that's swirling around in my head consistently with all of this is the disconnect between what Don Garber says about the aspirational nature of MLS and the actions that the owners are taking. It's a very conservative business model. Maybe that's part of the reason that they've grown to this point. They've gotten a lot of money into the league that may not have been there otherwise. But you can't say that you want to be top echelon, top tier, even if it's a nebulous concept, by 2022 if you're not willing to take this, what seems to be fairly innocuous step for most people, in a salary cap league.
Exactly. And that's the thing, too, is because the resistance to free agency is all about price controls. That's what the owners are saying. But if you are able to keep some sort of cap or luxury tax, that will take care of the price control question. And you have to have free agency if you're going to have a league that both grows and expands in terms of fan growth. I mean, and this is one of those things where arguing about it is sort of like arguing about whether the sky is blue. It's right. Like if you want to have an opinion that the sky is green, go at it. Have a blast. Have fun in your little world. But that's just not the truth. The sky is objectively blue. And in every single sport, free agency has been a prerequisite to growth because it adds to competition, it adds to fan interest, and it adds, frankly, to the ability to get in soccer in particular, the widest possible global talent pool. In a lot of ways, I would say free agency is a far more critical question for Major League Soccer than it was for something like the National Football League in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And it has helped every step of the way. The league will not grow the way Don Garber wants it to grow without it. And I can say, like, I would not never say, I'm sure 99% of your listeners know more about MLS than I do, but I will say that in the last year, I was able to go to games both in Seattle and Portland live. And it's impossible to be there and not think to yourself, whoa, you know, this is on the verge of something that could be pretty spectacular in terms of the U.S. sports scene. And so to pull the reins now just feels very short-sighted and also seems like it's awful timing.
I think that there may be something to the owners, and I don't know if I want to put this on Don Garber, who, again, is a commissioner who operates at the behest of the owners, but I certainly think that there's something to be said for the owners feeling like they've gotten here and they've had that success, and Portland and Seattle exist because of the way they did things, and that gives them a feeling that they can continue to do things this way. I don't know if that's mm-hmm. something that you maybe got from anybody that you talked to. The other element is this, and you talked about the American sports and getting to free agency and how painful those were very, very painful processes in a lot of cases, but they got there, and it ultimately did help their sports. And I think that it's interesting that we take free agency in our other four major sports and throw MLS in there if you want to. We take it for granted. And maybe that changes the way we view this as fans. I mean, it seems like, oh, free agency, that's a thing everybody has. Why doesn't it mm-hmm. exist? I think people are even surprised sometimes to hear that MLS doesn't have it.
No, exactly. I mean, there's a phrase for this in legal circles. It's called settled law. You know, it's like you feel like something like a police officer saying to you, you have the right to remain silent. Like it would be shocking if that law changed for the simple reason that it's become so part of the fabric of law that it's like, how could you even have an interaction with a police officer where they wouldn't say you have the right to remain silent?
Right.
And in this is a similar thing. It's like free agency is like settled law in the landscape of U.S. sports. And one of the things that I know feels, when I talk to people to do this article, feels particularly hypocritical is that there is free agency for executives. And you just saw this in Seattle with the signing of the new general manager, who was the general manager previously for Real Salt Lake. And it was very simple. You know, his contract ran out with Real Salt Lake. Seattle signed him up.
Mm-hmm.
And Garth Lagerwey. And the idea that there would be free agency for executives, that they would be able to have that freedom of movement. What that does is it creates competition and it creates a better product. Like I went into reading like a bunch of articles about the Sounders and how they made the decision to hire Garth from Real Salt Lake. And it comes down to the fact that the owner of the Sounders, who's been acting as GM, feels like he has something to offer in terms of growing the sport on a macro level. And so let someone else take care of player development and acquisition. And so you see like the Sounders are going to be stronger because of that. And it's like, to me, that very concept that you are stronger if you can go out and find the best talent. I mean, that's why it's so short-sighted to say, well, it's like, well, cost controls. It's like, no, you will grow the pie
mm-hmm.
if you're getting more players in, if you're getting players into different situations, if there's player movement, if players feel like they can go to the best possible situation. I mean, that'll change the way fans view MLS, and it'll grow the number of fans who are paying attention to the sport.
There's an element to these negotiations that is, you know, whether or not the public's view of the situation and the public's support or lack thereof for one side or the other sways either side, I suppose it's debatable, especially in a league like MLS, which is unique in the way it operates, in how old it is, how entrenched some of these owners are in terms of the money that they've spent mm-hmm. and whether or not they're willing to spend more. But you definitely point out that the players union, and this is the way I feel about it as well, sitting here in front of a microphone wanting to talk to people and get exactly what, you know, maybe not what's going on behind the scenes, but certainly get the message out. Is the players union doing anything on that front that is good enough for you?
Well, this is why I called the article, and I had a big talk with my editors about titles. And as any author will tell you, that's what you have least control over when you write an article, is the title. And this was one I really wanted this title. It's called Can Players Win a Strike Against Major League Soccer? Because I think that for all the talk of unity among the players, the union itself is making a couple of really, really big mistakes. And you, the symbol of that mistake is you go to the MLS Players Union website, and you would never know that there could be a league-altering, earth-shaking strike about to happen. I mean, their homepage should be filled with information about what's happening in labor negotiations, but also it should be filled with links about what fans could do if they want to support the players. If what Timber's Army, what the Emerald City supporters, what all the fan clubs, what they could do if they want to support the players. I just think that what they're missing, a golden opportunity to do what in the broader labor movement is sometimes referred to as a contract campaign or a corporate campaign, where you don't just make it about what's happening across the bargaining table and who can stay out one day longer or whose strike fund is bigger. You know, it becomes these like very economic meat and potatoes questions, when what it could be is much more of a social movement question. And that's the power that soccer has, big picture, over every other sport on the landscape. In that fans feel this sense of ownership of their teams, and they will fight for their teams.
Do you connect some of that to the decline of unions in this country in general? I mean sports, athletic unions, just in general. And then, you know, is there something to be said for, and maybe you're less aware of this than I am, the insular nature of American soccer and the fact that they think, okay, this is something between us. We've got to resolve this. This doesn't involve anybody outside of our little circle.
Yeah, no. I think on the second point, I see insular nature all over the place in how they're even thinking about this or discussing it, because I know that when there have been labor disputes in the past in La Liga or the English Premier League, one of the things that you have seen is the mobilization of the fan clubs. Now, oftentimes that mobilization happens independently of being asked. The fan clubs, I mean, they're politicized, they're out there, they want their team on the field, and they're going to organize and fight, whether it's a coach getting fired or whether it's a team not being able to play because they're not being taken care of financially. Like, fans will fight for their players. And so some of that, I think, is totally cultural. Like you mentioned about the United States, we have historically low levels of union participation. And so one wonders if it even occurs to the MLS Players Union to say, gee, we might be able to get some solidarity in the community. Like, if that's something that was even something that was put to the table in front of them. But it's like, it should be something that they think about. Because, I mean, you go to a Sounders game, I mean, people are singing Woody Guthrie songs, for goodness sakes. Like, they're taking old labor songs in Seattle and turning them into soccer anthems. You go to a Timbers game, they're making TIFOs around social issues all the time, whether it's women's rights, anti-racism, gay rights. They're making these TIFOs to try to, like, put politics as part of what Timbers Army is doing. And, of course, they both of them do these amazing marches to the stadium before games. And so it's like, it's not a big stretch to think, hey, can we connect with them and get them to publicly support us in a way that the media would find very attractive, in a way that would draw a lot of attention? I mean, that's the sort of thing that would be in the first 10 minutes of SportsCenter, you know, rally of 30,000 people in downtown Portland to get the Timbers back on the field. And so I'm concerned that they are not using one of the best arrows in their quiver in the MLS Players Union, and that's the fans.
I imagine it's a lack of experience on this front. The Players Union, you know, isn't very old, as you point out in your piece. The strike fund is relatively small compared to anything else. And there's also, you know, again, there's sort of, I get the sense, maybe not from some of the players who were taking leadership positions and speaking out, and there have been a couple, mostly in the little tiny soccer bubbles that we live in around here. But certainly it seems like some of the players, this is all sort of, you know, maybe they feel a little cheeky about pushing this, that, oh, you know, 20 years ago we didn't have jobs. Are we really in a position to do this? I mean, there's some adamant statements that maybe don't necessarily connect with the way that it, I don't know, the feeling around this. I mean, it doesn't feel like the players are really, I don't know how to say this, Dave. I mean, it certainly doesn't feel like a strike in baseball or football or hockey where, you know these guys mean business and there's really no question. Mm-hmm. I think we're all concerned that if you're on the player side, you're concerned that they're going to fold.
Yeah, and the concern about, I mean, there's been a couple of very, very strong statements about unity and resolve. Former player Taylor Twellman, he had a very quotable comment saying that this is our Curt Flood moment. Saying really, I mean, and that was like the moment in Major League Baseball. The Curt Flood moment means this is where we are willing to sacrifice to win free agency. But the sort of irony of him saying that is that Curt Flood was drummed out of Major League Baseball, right, lost his case, and never actually felt the benefits of that. So on one respect, it's like, I'm glad he's recalling that history and the heroism of Curt Flood. I really hope it's not their Curt Flood moment. I hope it's their Andy Messersmith, Dave McNally moment.
Right.
I hope it's their Reggie White moment. You know, I hope it's their winning moment. I hear what you're saying about that, though. And the concern, I mean, really, is that you also have this influx of stars who are coming in 2015 and very high profile players, and how wedded are they going to be to this union struggle? Mm-hmm. And you can understand why maybe they wouldn't be. I mean, what sense of ownership do they have over this union? What sense of ownership do they have over the long-term future of MLS, as opposed to just being like, hey, you know, I'm a little bit past my prime. This is a place where I can totally get paid, and I have a huge fan base here, and do my thing. And so that to me is a big concern too. Some of the comments have been spectacular. I'm sure you've seen them. Players like Michael Bradley said very positive things. But you want to see a sense of engagement. And once again, I got to get back to this contract campaign piece, because if I'm seeing players not being engaged and I'm actually in the union, I'm thinking, what can I do to get them engaged? You know, I'm not expecting them to be Norma Ray. These are soccer players. You know, they're not going to be self-starting union organizers. It's like you actually have to give them very directed tasks.
Yeah.
And so that's something, and that's one of the things that would be great. Like, imagine if you went to the MLS Players Union website and there was news in your local city about a rally that was going to be held where Michael Bradley was going to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the sort of thing you would click on and see. I mean, that wouldn't only be on SportsCenter, that would be on the local nightly news. Mm-hmm. And it would turn the heat up dramatically on the ownership side.
You know, there's a lot of things running through my head as to perhaps some of the reasons for this. Again, the youth of the union itself, the fact that this is a union,
yes,
unlike any other American sports union, meaning that it is made up of players from around the world, not just the United,
mm-hmm,
States. The fact that so many of the American players, which are ultimately usually the leadership at this point, are quite often, they're very well educated guys. They graduated from college with degrees. They may have something to fall back on if this doesn't work out, or at the very least, they may not have a blue collar mentality that it usually takes to get to the point where you imagine, you know, drumming up rallies.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, no, and you're right. And this is where, I mean, a union needs to be a school for these kinds of things. Now, I hear you 5 trillion% about the newness of the union. And also, sports unions are built on tradition. And you talk about this being a new union. My God, the stories of the early years, for example, of the Major League Baseball union before Marvin Miller was hired on, the legendary steelworker organizer that they brought in to lead it. I mean, but it was a disaster. It was an absolute disaster. Same with the early years of the union and the other major sports. I mean, there's always these growing pains as people figure out what to do. But one thing that MLS union has both the burden and the blessing at this particular moment is none of those other unions in their early years faced a strike, mm-hmm, so soon. And a strike can be one hell of a teacher. You know, there's an old expression in social struggles that sometimes in normal life, it takes years to learn the lesson that might take days. But when you're in struggle, in days, you could learn the lessons that other times take years. So it's like, okay, they're new, they're young. What do you have to lose?
Yeah.
You know, see if you can give it a try to spread the message. See if you could give it a try, to make the owners think for a second that the fans have actually taken a side on this question, because that's very powerful.
It's fascinating. There's so many elements to this, and we could do this all day, Dave, but I'm going to let you go. Thank you very much for coming back on the show. Hopefully we can talk to you after the resolution to this situation, whatever it might be. I think I think most MLS fans would love to see the players get free agency, but I don't know that they're willing to sacrifice the start of their season at the moment.
No, I know, and that's what we're going to see. And just real quick message to you, this show is terrific. Like, I've been just noticing, like, when I said I was going to be on, you have a very, very loyal following
for your show.
So congrats. That's very tough in this media climate. Congratulations, man.
Yeah, it's all, you know what? It's all on them. The grassroots word-of-mouth stuff is fantastic. Dave Zirin, Edge of Sports on Twitter, sports editor over at The Nation, which is where you can read the piece on whether or not the players can win a strike. Thanks for your time, Dave, and have a good weekend.
You too. Thanks.
All right, there you go. Let's wrap up this episode of Soccer Morning on a Friday. Go enjoy your soccer. I didn't get into the schedule. It's okay. Come back on Monday. We'll do another great show. Go to 3NLFC.com to buy your T-shirt for Soccer Morning. Go to backheel.com/store to get a mug, a very beautiful white mug with the logo on it. The coffee tastes fantastic coming out of it. And that's it. Thank you very much to our guests today, Daryl Lovell, Thomas Floyd, Dave Zirin. I'll talk to you guys Monday. Bye.